From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. Idaho's superintendent of public instruction has been watching the Idaho legislature closely this year as lawmakers consider giving public schools a giant chunk of the state budget. Debbie Critchfield is in her second year as the head of Idaho's public K-12 school system. And now that the legislature is wrapping up, she's about to go on a statewide tour to talk with school officials about education policy coming out of the legislature this year and how it will impact schools and students. She agreed to give us a preview last week, and we started off the conversation with the roughly $2 billion school facilities bill, which passed this session. So let's take a listen. So, as you know, Governor Little signed the school facilities and tax relief bill. So that is earmarking about $1.5 billion over 10 years. And for folks who aren't aware, that means this is for schools to use for building, construction, and maintenance. What are your thoughts on the bill? I would assume you're happy about it.
Very happy, supportive throughout the process. About a year ago, I think the state became very serious about focusing on solutions for our maintenance and facilities needs. It really had become a problem to local taxpayers. Because of the way that schools are paid for, the state doesn't pay for construction of new facilities. There's a little money that goes into repairs and maintenance. But the deferred maintenance over time, combined with growth in a lot of our areas for new schools, had put a burden on to local communities to pay for that separate than the taxes that they send into the state. And so we saw some working groups come together. The education community came together to say, how do we alleviate the problem in a couple of ways while not making it so specific to a zip code as to whether or not a school passed a levy or bond?
Well, and I think, too, I mean, what was interesting to me about this is the numerous stories that have come out over this last year about in just what disrepair schools are in. And as you being superintendent of public instruction, how does learning get impacted by facilities? And I ask that because I think sometimes people have a difficult time seeing that they do correlate.
Here's a great example. We're coming out of winter, thankfully. We have schools around the state that are operating on boilers that are 60 years old or more. The boiler goes down. You don't just go to your local hardware store and buy a part. You have to have it machined somewhere in the Northwest or the Midwest, and then it gets shipped to you. Well, in the meantime, you don't have heat. And so you are either trying to figure out how to plug in space heaters, which our fire marshals don't like, or you don't have school. And so on particularly cold days, there are interruptions to learning. Now, I know that that seems like an extreme example, but when you look around our state and see the age of many of our facilities, these are very normal and likely examples of things that can happen. And then added to that, just the learning spaces, the needs are different. And so schools that were built with an open concept in the 1970s that don't have walls, and you walk in and it's just classrooms everywhere, and teachers have put up filing cabinets to create walls so that they can have their own classroom. Those types of things interrupt the learning.
Mm-hmm. So this bill also removes the August election date for school districts. So that means that districts now can only hold a bond or a levy election in May or November. In your mind, how big of a challenge is that going to be for schools that still need more money? Because even though this seems like a lot of money, it still isn't going to fix every problem that there is.
Well, let's start with that. This is a significant effort and towards alleviating some of these problems, but it is not the silver bullet. There will still be a need for school bonds for new construction. So $1 billion across the state for 10 years, there is no question that you can't even wrap your mind around how much money that is. There will still be other facilities needs. So for the first part of what you said, removing that August date, to be honest, August was less critical in the whole scheme of the election opportunities than March was. And that got removed last year just because of the way that a local taxing cycles work. August was a tricky date in communities anyway, which it isn't to say that districts weren't taking advantage of it. Do I think that this is the make or break by removing August? I don't.
So can we talk about four-day school weeks, which have become pretty popular among Idaho school districts? And what are your thoughts on a four-day school week? Is it, and I guess what has feedback been, not just from teachers, but the impact to families? Has this been a negative, a positive?
It really depends on where you're in the state. Mm. Different communities have different expectations. One of the things that I advise school districts to think about is to not make these decisions lightly. Take some time, talk to your community. For most districts, they study and look at it for at least a year, if not longer, before they determine that 4-day is going to work or we want to stay at 5-day, and that we want the decisions to be focused around what's good for kids, not what's good for the adult workforce.
So I want to talk a little bit about last week as well. There was an appropriation for the Workforce Development Council, and this provides nearly $71 million for the Idaho Launch Grants, and that was passed by the legislature recently. This program will give more graduating seniors here in our state up to $8,000 for career training. So I'm curious about how that program is working right now.
Well, we'll have our first group of graduating seniors that will be able to access the funds. So last year, the policy piece of launch went into place. And then this year, it was followed up with monies being appropriated. And it was very aggressively pursued. And there were more students that applied for the grants than what they had money for. And I think that that's a great sign. And I'm confident that as our students make good decisions on what to do with those funds, how to give themselves the skills, the opportunity, the exposure that they need, that there are jobs waiting here in Idaho for them.
And how critically important is that? Because there is, I'm a big believer on the fact that not everyone is meant for a 4-year degree. With that said, it is very difficult to be able to be financially successful and stable if you only have a high school diploma. So what does money like this do for those students who maybe know that, you know, this, maybe a 4-year degree not only is not right for them, maybe it's unattainable based on finances, life, all of those things that we all end up dealing with.
I don't know that I could say it better than what you just said. I wholeheartedly agree that there isn't a one-size-fits-all for students. And we do a good job of connecting students to higher education. And what I'd like to do, and I think Launch provides the vehicle to actually make it happen, is elevate everything else in the state. We see students that leave high school with industry-recognized certificates, experience in an apprenticeship or an internship, that have marketable, transferable skills that are industry recognized, they can go get a job. Now, if you want to have a great paying job and this is the career I want for life, good for you. Many of our students have those jobs while they're pursuing a college degree. Mm-hmm. I think it comes down to providing students the options and then giving them the tools to help them be successful. It's that jump start, the launch, I guess, to use the term.
A good word right there. So let's talk a little bit about career technical education programs, because there's been about $40 billion in $1 billion has been approved for nearly 60 grants in this career technical education. So tell us more about why, again, this, not only is this plan important to you, but I think in particular in our rural areas of the state, where it seems so many times we overlook that area of our state and those kids who were growing up there.
Career technical education is a real priority and a passion of mine. And again, jumping off of the points that you've shared, I think it we can look at rural Idaho and tell our kids there are great jobs in your own backyard. There are industries here that are desperate for workers. So mm-hmm. One of the examples that I love to use is the logging, forestry, and timber industry in the northern part of our state. We have an industry that is losing loggers. People are retiring, and we don't have another generation to come behind them and take those jobs. Many of the jobs in the mills are highly technical jobs. For students that are interested in computers and kids that are good at gaming, they can work a lot of the equipment and the machinery at the mills. Now, why do we care about that? Well, the timber sales on state lands in Idaho go into an endowment. that benefit public education. And in December, I got to stand by a big check to public education that said we were getting $65 million. 90% of that $65 million came from timber sales.
Wow.
So how are we feeding this biosphere? And we have kids that are watching family members that have participated, and you can fill in the blank. It doesn't have to be logging or timber, mm-hmm. but many other industries around the state. And we don't want to tell our kids you have to go outside of the state to have a good life. They want to stay not only in their own state, but in their own communities. Career technical education is how we provide them the skills, the training, and the know-how to be able to make that possible.
You know, I grew up in Western Washington, and when you talk about mills and you talk about timber, I mean, that was the lifeblood of the county that I grew up in. And I knew so many kids from my high school who went into that. However, there was still such a push for higher education that, you know, X amount of years later, once again, you're looking for people to fill those jobs. And do you think that there has been a need to really push this four-year education, but at the same time, it's almost like we push that so much that did we let these other career technical jobs almost go by the wayside? And therefore, you almost leave these kids floundering who maybe don't want or need to be in that four-year program, if that makes sense.
It does. And I think a lot of what you're describing can be explained in a mentality over some of the jobs. And so we talk about, you know, dirty jobs and some mm-hmm. of these other things. We need our medical doctors. We absolutely do. We also need people who can build roads, and we need people who, you know, that work for power companies and all of those things. And we see a generational swing back towards some of those jobs that I think got put to the side. Oh, we need everybody to go to college to be successful.
Right.
And for many of our parents, we're trying to convince parents, when your child says they want to go to lineman school, celebrate that, encourage that. We want them to be able to do that. If your child wants to become a diesel mechanic, you absolutely need to go look and see what the benefits of being in that profession and that industry are. And so we're trying to shift mentalities and get away from this one size fits all, mm-hmm. but use the educational system that we have, particularly 7th through 12th grade, to allow our students to explore in all of these industries. So when we talk about career technical education, most people think of welding or ag-related things, and that's right, but it's also culinary. It's graphic design. It's a hands-on approach to you taking the knowledge and then putting it into practice, and now you can do something.
I want to pivot a little bit and talk a little bit about nutrition, because a lot of people may not know the Department of Education oversees child nutrition programs here in Idaho. You know that, but some people may not. So these are entitlement programs that were funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and they include things like school meals, the summer food service, child and adult care food programs. So again, how important are healthy meals to our Idaho children, in particular, when in the legislature, they are arguing right now about the necessity to feed children, in particular, over the summer?
Yes, we watch the debates as well, and you try to find where, you know, where people are, and I think for some people, it becomes a philosophical discussion and a philosophical question. What and where should the government provide, and what does that look like? The other side of that coin is we have students who come to school that have insecure food sources mm-hmm. for reasons out of their control, may not have access to regular meals. And for some kids, having, you know, a breakfast and lunch at school during the year and access to lunch in the summer is an important part of their overall development. And so trying to wade through the politics of feeding kids, we're saying, okay, well, we have hungry kids, and we know that there are political philosophies around that. How do we combine those, or how do we work through that so that we don't have issues of hungry kids mm-hmm. at schools?
Well, and then with that, this spring, the state's largest sponsor of child care centers and homes in the state, Nutrition Works, actually stopped operating, as you know. So a lot of these centers and these daycare home providers rely on that funding from the USDA to actually stay in business. So again, how is the state, and I guess your department, if at all, is ensuring uninterrupted access to this program?
Well, the decisions of the legislature aside on the summer food program, that really was an extension of some food programs during COVID. Mm-hmm. And I think some people would say, COVID is enough in the rearview mirror. Is it necessary to, you know, to still keep that existing summer program? Putting that to the side, there are existing summer food programs that we would encourage anyone that would be interested in hosting as a food site. It can be nonprofit, it could be a church, it could be a business, that there are opportunities to work with the Department of Education, and we'd encourage folks to reach out to us if you're interested in being available to serve food during the summer. We've got some other opportunities that have been longstanding to provide for some families.
So getting back to this idea of you know, almost politicizing hungry kids. And I think part of the argument has been about, well, COVID was 4 years ago. As you said, we're beyond that. There were hungry kids before COVID. So how does that play into all of this, or having people understand that? I mean, yes, did we see more problems, right, with trying to make sure kids were fed? But COVID didn't make hungry kids.
No, I think that it brought to the forefront some of the needs in greater ways than maybe even schools were aware of. And so what are the roles? Mm-hmm. I think that that's a discussion that we're going to have over time. What's the role of the school? What's the role of the family? What's the role of government? And for a time, those were meshed together in ways to help solve some of these problems. And so now that, you know, we're, as you've said, moving beyond COVID, I think there's been talk of how do we readjust? What is the right thing? What is the right role? Nonetheless, we still have this problem. And looking to make sure that, you know, our most vulnerable citizens, our children, have access to some of these things in spite of what their families can or would like to be able to do. Hungry kids turn up at schools. Mm-hmm. What are schools going to do with them? This is something we've got to figure out so that it doesn't become so controversial.
So you're about to embark on a pretty big tour of the state. You're going to meet with administrators and educators all over the state. Can you talk to us a little bit about some of the concerns that maybe you're expecting to hear from some of these administrators and educators as you embark on this?
They're all going to want to know about the distribution of their funds from the facilities law that the governor recently signed, as they should. When are money's going to be available? You know, what are the requirements of the law? So we expect to get into a lot of details about that, along with the overall public schools budget. And one of the things that I really worked hard on was getting the legislature to support a supplemental amount that was this gap between how we funded during COVID and a return to how we fund now pre-COVID and what was left on the table. And that was really important. As the legislature said, we're going to put $330 million additional dollars into the public schools budget. What happened, because of the formula that was used, money was left on the table. Mm. And so I said to districts, we're going to go back next session. We're going to ask for that difference to become accessible. And then I'm going to bring a policy bill next year that will help us ensure that we don't find ourselves in the same place. So money is always a big part of this. Schools are planning their budgets. They're determining what teachers are going to have where, all of those things. And so those really will be probably the two top priorities.
So I want to talk a little bit about absenteeism when it comes to schools. This is a crisis that we are seeing across the country. And in fact, the New York Times has been covering this quite extensively. And the Idaho Education News actually reported that in the school year of 2021-2022, about 20% of students here in Idaho were chronically absent. Now, when we talk chronically absent, just for folks who have an understanding, that means you miss at least 10% of the school year. That's a significant amount. So are things getting better here in our state? And what's being done to really address this issue? Because again, I mean, I don't necessarily want to, you know, go back to COVID and say, well, you know, kids started missing school because of COVID, because we had absenteeism issues. But this disrupts learning so much, and not just for the children that are missing school, but it's for the kids that are in school, and people may not be aware of that.
I think the absenteeism is one of the most unfortunate ripple effects of COVID. Again, it's a mentality that many of our students and our families have. I think schools were so nimble and so flexible because we had to be. How are we going to deliver the education? Okay, you didn't get your homework in on time. Okay, you didn't log in. We were all in real time trying to figure out how to do what we were doing. Well, this is one of those things where we say, that's past. We've got to get serious about getting kids back into school. And that's been a struggle. It's been hard for our teachers and our administrators to light some fires under kids. And there's it's just a culture now that has developed where kids think, well, can I just do it online, or does it really matter if I don't turn it in? And we're coaching and asking our districts to get serious about the consequences of not being at school, communicating that with families. And we need kids in school. That's where the learning takes place. And it's not about the money, but it really is about the learning loss. Mm-hmm. And this sort of lackadaisical attitude about going to school, I'm concerned.
You know, it's interesting too, because this report that the New York Times has been doing, one of the things that stuck out to me in their reporting was when they looked at more affluent families compared to families who are struggling more economically. And there may be this assumption that it's the poorer kids that are missing school. And what they're finding is that they're all missing school. And and if you have a chronically absent student, it doesn't necessarily matter if they're very affluent or not. It's just that what the New York Times in their reporting has found is that these children that have more issues economically are sometimes missing school because maybe they're in a single parent household and it's harder for the parent to get them to school. Maybe they're struggling with anxiety or mental health issues, but there are barriers to getting them to school, right? Whereas with affluent families, they were like, well, they learned online during COVID, let's go on a 2-week vacation, and not seeing the potential harm in their child not being in school. So I'm curious just about your thoughts on that, because
described Idaho. Absolutely. Absolutely. It is. It's interesting when you break it down that across the board, it's not a kind of kid or in a certain part of the state. And what I hear from teachers has been very interesting to add another layer to this, that in some places for high school kids, well, I'm not going to make it to first hour. I'll stay second, third hour, and then I'm not really feeling up to it. I think I'll go home for the rest of the day. And parents signing off on that somehow they're going to capture the learning somewhere and, you know, with osmosis or I don't know. But when we look at the attitudes, it really is an attitude of, you know, and I think that we've had a lot of positive things in education as a result of COVID. Mm-hmm. There are things that we do better and we do differently because we were forced into it, and that's great. And now we're going to be better at it. This is one of those aspects that we're going to have to change how we think about what we expect of kids and what the responsibilities for their own learning is, and how parents help ensure that the learning takes place as well.
You know, it feels like the legislature is increasing scrutiny and intends to make some fundamental changes to public education in Idaho. What can you say about the work being done across the state and how that might contrast with the negative perceptions of some? And basically what I'm asking is that there was, and I think will continue to be, a push for quote-unquote school choice.
School choice is an interesting couple of words together, because I think a bunch of things have been thrown into that to create a new definition to suit different ends. Idaho, without question, honors, protects, defends school choice, defined as a parent's right and ability to choose the learning environment that their child has. And I will support and defend a parent's right to choose all day long. School choice, as we have seen it in the legislature over the last couple of years, has really taken on a meaning of a parent doesn't get their choice unless the state pays for it. So nothing about legislation that I've seen recently takes away a parent's right to choose. And I'm so happy for that because we don't want to go backwards. But we look at what Idaho offers. We were ranked third in the country for educational freedom, the ability to make that decision. And I think why we haven't seen the role of state government involved in a parent's choice as far as legislation being successful, I don't know that we found the right fit for Idaho. What works in another state, it's maybe not the right fit here. And so I haven't talked to any legislator who doesn't believe in school choice, the parent's ability to make a choice. Then the question and the philosophical points come in to say, well, what's the role of government in paying for everyone's choices? And then what parts of accountability need to be included in that? And I think that's why we keep discussing it at the levels that we do, because we haven't found that balance.
So my last question for you has to do with the University of Phoenix and all of the controversy surrounding that. You've been a longtime member of the State Board of Education. You've seen some things in your time. No question about that. What are your thoughts, if at all, on this controversy around University of Phoenix being purchased by the University of Idaho?
I think anything or anytime something very new and different is presented, it can throw people off. And, you know, when I was first presented with the possibility of going down this road and what does it look like, I asked many of the same questions that I've heard other people ask. Okay, does this make sense? Why would we do this? You know, all of the things. And as there were answers supported by data and evidence and, you know, all of these things along the way, I kept going back to how we look at higher ed in a different way. This was an opportunity to think differently, to provide an avenue for all students in the state. And I made a comparison to one of the first experiences that I had as a brand new board member when the state welcomed in a for-profit medical school. And there were many criticisms of that. People looked at that and said, that'll never fly. That's a bad idea. The state's going to be at risk. Now we don't even think about it. We just say, well, we have a medical school. And we're so happy that we have one. And so, you know, I thought of different experiences. And then I look at what the value is. So the deal that was, you know, put together almost a year ago now at this point, for the seller to go and sell that, it's almost tripled in the value. And we see what it's generating year after year. And so I had a lot of my, well, all of my questions answered. And I'm willing to say, why wouldn't we explore this if we believe these other things are in place? Now, other people have different opinions of that. The legislature has had a different opinion of that. And, you know, I always will support our college presidents looking at different ways to deliver education.
I want to thank you so much for taking time today to talk to us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.